From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Monday, November 20th, 2017. And on this day, the campaign to convince Senator Susan Collins to vote yay or nay on the Republican tax reform bill heats up. And we'll begin our series on hepatitis C in Maine. That's all ahead in just a moment.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners like you and by Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens, presenting Gardens Aglow, where visitors will see the gardens in a whole new light, now through December 31st. MaineGardens.org.
So, have you heard that there is a Republican tax reform plan in the Senate? I know. Well, Maine Senator Susan Collins is hearing about it on a lot of fronts, or her constituents are, from various groups and ads and by phone. Mal Leary has more.
One TV ad airing in the state urges Senator Collins to vote for the Senate Republican tax plan, touting it as a tax cut. Another ad from a different political action committee denounces both the Senate and House versions of tax legislation.
Thankfully, Senator Susan Collins told us that she'd say no to tax breaks for the wealthiest. Call her and tell her not to lose her way.
In an interview with Maine Public Radio, Collins laughed and said, as a moderate, she is used to groups trying to pressure her to vote for and against various issues and nominees.
There are ad campaigns encouraging me to vote against the bill, and ad campaigns and telephone campaigns urging me to vote for the bill. I'm used to that. That's what happens when you're in the center.
Collins says she does not expect either the Senate GOP or the House GOP tax bill to be passed as drafted. She says she and several other senators have concerns about one or more provisions in the draft legislation. For example, Collins wants more of the tax cuts to go to middle-income taxpayers. She'd pay for that by keeping the current highest tax rate on incomes over $1 million a year. Another concern, she says she does not like tacking repeal of the health care mandate onto the tax legislation.
You're right that I have problems with each of the versions of the bills, but I don't think at the end of the day that's the choice that I'm going to be confronted with. The choice that I'm going to be confronted with will be an amended bill.
Collins says she's already working on amendments she will offer when the Senate takes up tax changes next week. One would continue to allow taxpayers to deduct state and local taxes on their federal returns, but would include a cap. She also wants to see the corporate tax rate lowered from the current rate of 35%, but she says she's not sure by how much. Resolving that question will be part of the discussions in the weeks ahead. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Mal Leary.
Federal regulators are shutting down fishing rights for a significant portion of New England's stressed groundfish stocks like cod and flounder. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration says managers for a New Bedford Mass-based sector undermined conservation goals while disgraced fishing magnate Carlos Rafael was falsifying catch reports. Fred Bever has our story.
There are 19 groundfish sectors in the Northeast, each representing a group of fishermen who manage catch quotas set by NOAA regulators. Sector 9 is dominated by boats based in New Bedford, Mass. And owned by Carlos Rafael, also known as the Codfather, who started a nearly four-year jail sentence in Fort Devens, Mass. This month after he confessed to falsifying catch information. Federal regulators say Sector 9 officials, including Raphael's daughter, failed to develop information to show that quotas were no longer being violated, and so its fishermen won't be allowed to catch more groundfish this fishing year, which ends in April, or the next year, if a valid new management plan isn't offered.
They do need to make significant changes, and until they do, their boats will be tied to the dock.
John Bullard is NOAA's regional administrator. He says lacking reliable data, it's difficult to assess damage already done to various species in the Gulf of Maine, but it is significant.
They've exceeded stocks, quotas of cod, of yellowtail flounder, and which flounder, and dabs by perhaps as much as a whole year's quota.
In New Bedford, Mayor John Mitchell says Carlos Rafael deserves condemnation and his prison sentence, but he adds that a piecemeal approach to the disposition of Rafael's permits by criminal, civil, and administrative action is creating hardship for innocent bystanders.
By keeping these boats in port, there will be crew members who, you know, won't have an opportunity to earn a living over the next 6 months, and there will be shoreside businesses, including ice and fuel suppliers, as well as net menders and settlement houses that will lose a portion of their business.
But away from New Bedford, others are cheering the decision.
This is very positive.
Ben Martins is executive director of the Maine Coast Fishermen's Association, which manages one of the 19 sectors. He says Rafael's scam distorted the entire market for New England's historic cod and flounder fisheries, as well as scientific assessments of their health.
Fishing vessels throughout New England who have been doing things the right way out on the water have been hoping that NOAA will come down on this sector and say, you are breaking the rules, there are repercussions for breaking the rules.
That could include reductions in Sector 9's future quotas to make up for overfishing that may have occurred. In the meantime, other sectors will still be able to fish their full quotas, but they won't be able to trade quota leases with Sector 9 boats. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Fred Bever.
The White House has declared the opioid crisis a national public health emergency, but that's also fueling another epidemic, a rise in hepatitis C. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control says the number of new hepatitis C infections has tripled since 2010. About 3.5 million people in the U.S. have the disease, which is most often spread through intravenous drug use. Needle exchanges are being promoted as an effective tool to prevent further spread of the infection, but public health advocates in Maine say the state doesn't have nearly enough of them. In the first of a three-part series on hepatitis C, Patty White visits a needle exchange program in Bangor.
It's easy to pass by the needle exchange in Bangor without noticing it, and that's kind of the idea. The people who come here don't want to draw unwanted attention. They use intravenous drugs, and they come to this unmarked brick building just a few blocks from the heart of downtown to exchange dirty needles for clean ones.
Besides alcohol wipes, do you have anything else you'd like?
The ties.
Okay. Do you have a preference of ties?
Yes.
It's summertime, and staff member Gretchen Ziemer is helping a woman we'll call Sarah with new syringes and other supplies. Sarah and her husband have been using the needle exchange off and on during periods of relapse for about a year.
We come here because it's safe. You know, it really, I'm sure, has saved our life on many occasions.
Using intravenous drugs and sharing or reusing needles put Sarah and her husband at risk for contracting viruses that are spread through blood, such as HIV or hepatitis C.
I have children, you know, that I want to be there for, even though not every choice that I make is a good choice.
Great, thank you.
Hepatitis C is a liver infection. When people first contract it, they don't usually have any symptoms. That's why most infections become chronic, which leads to liver disease and cancer. Baby boomers account for a high percentage of hepatitis C cases, but the rise in intravenous drug use from the opioid epidemic has caused a sharp increase in new infections in younger people. The number of acute cases has tripled in recent years.
Hep C is generally considered or has been called a silent epidemic as far as the U.S. CDC is concerned because it's gone unnoticed for so long.
Kenny Miller is the executive director of the Health Equity Alliance, which operates the needle exchange in Bangor.
So this is the exchange office.
Miller opens the door to a room that's about the size of a large closet.
The first time they come in and we do a client intake, which involves a lot of questions around, what they're using, when they started using, other things that they might be facing in terms of homelessness, law enforcement involvement.
After the intake interview, clients drop their used needles into a bin on the wall and get clean supplies in exchange. Some return every day, others in a week or month. At first, many clients aren't interested in talking much, and the staffers don't push it, because the goal of the exchange, Miller says, isn't just to prevent infections.
Beyond that, it's about the relationship with this incredibly hard-to-reach population that engages with so few other points of care in the world at large.
Over time, Miller says, as clients learn to trust staff, they tend to open up more. When they signal that they're ready for help with their addiction, they can be linked with resources. Heath DeLate says had he not walked through the exchange's doors about a decade ago,
I'd probably be dead. Like, legit. No joke.
DeLate, who is now 29, says at first he came purely for the needles, and even that was difficult.
Oh, it was scary. It was scary. I figured I would be judged and think I was trash because I was using needles.
But he says the staff was kind. Eventually, they became like an extended family.
They all, like, have you back, pretty much. When you come here, you can talk to them, you can confide in them, you can vent with them, anything.
It took several years for DeLate to decide that he wanted to stop using. He was connected to treatment and has been off heroin for about 6 years. He now volunteers at the exchange. He loads and unloads deliveries for the food pantry, takes care of the trash, whatever is needed.
I'm very happy that there's a place like this in existence, because if there weren't, then I don't know what I'd be doing right now, because like it's given me like a sense of purpose.
And DeLate also managed to avoid contracting hepatitis C. His story supports findings that intravenous drug users are 5 times more likely to enter treatment when they use a needle exchange. Maine has 6 in the state. Aside from Bangor, the Health Equity Alliance operates 2 others in Ellsworth and Machias. There are also exchanges in Portland, Augusta, and Lewiston. Altogether, they serve about 2,700 people a year. But Ross Hicks, the harm reduction coordinator for the Health Equity Alliance, says that's not enough. Some clients in northern Maine, he says, drive 2 hours to the Bangor exchange to drop off used needles.
We have somebody that comes down, I think, every month, but he comes down with 2 5-gallon buckets because, again, there isn't a syringe exchange north of Bangor, so he's collecting for a community.
Some advocates have made a case that Maine should have at least 1 needle exchange in every county. The Health Equity Alliance has tried to get state funding to establish new needle exchanges and support existing ones. The legislature considered 2 bills that would have each allocated $75,000, but both had their funding stripped and one was vetoed. Kenny Miller of the Health Equity Alliance says the lack of public support for these kinds of centers is fueled by a common misperception.
We still have to combat this idea that it's enabling and that we're helping people to use drugs somehow as opposed to helping them to stay healthy.
Miller says they also save the state money by preventing hepatitis C infections, which cost Maine's Medicaid program about $17 million last year to treat. A new emergency request to the legislature would provide $75,000 to support needle exchanges. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Patty White.
For more on today's Maine news, visit our website, mainepublic.org. And from Maine Public, that's This Day in Maine for Monday, November 20th, 2017. Thanks to Ed Morin and our digital team, I'm Nora Flaherty.